Access number 29549, this is John McGough, Real 5. Now, we got to the point, you qualified in mid-April on the Hotspur at number 5 Glider Training School, and then in the same month you go to the next posting, which is number 1 Heavy Glider Conversion Unit at Bryars Norton. Is that correct? Which is also in April. You seem to start flying horses on your logbook in April anyway, late April.
That'll be correct, yes, of course.
What do you remember of converting to the halter at Bryars Norton?
I think I've already mentioned to you I've not seen a halter prior to going down to Bryars Norton. I was astounded by the size of them. They got a wingspan of 88 feet and they could carry 20 to 30 fully armed soldiers. The size compared to the comparatively mini size of the Hotspur, that was the main thing. And another thing I noticed was the room in the cockpit for the two pilots. Plenty of room and plenty of visibility. Sat side by side. So you weren't sort of cramped in like you were in the Hotspur. So that was my first impression before I flew them.
And what were they like to fly?
They were an absolutely beautiful aircraft. Beautiful aircraft.
In what way? What was so good about them?
In that they responded very, very quickly to the controls that you use. They responded very quickly, and there were terrific visibility for the two pilots at the front, and they were a nice, stable, comfortable aircraft to fly.
And what would tow them?
Oh dear, I have to think for a moment.
You've got three men, well, two I've seen mentioned, Halifax's, Albemarle's and Whitley's, the two of them.
Well,
what was the most usual?
The usual thing was a Halifax. I've been told behind Halifax more than any of the other types, so probably was a Halifax, which is a four-engine aircraft.
Now, so what was it like flying? Can you give us an idea of what a typical flight in a horse was like?
Well, We're allocating an RAF instructor, and he flew with you, and he'd explain the controls, which we're using, but he would explain the use of the controls.
And also, any different from the Hotspur?
No, not at all. Not at all. And the same rules of thumb applied. You kept directly behind the towing aircraft, not to either side and not too high above. And then we take off and probably do a cross-country all over around Oxfordshire and the adjoining counties, about for 45 minutes or an hour, just learning to control the aircraft. And the instructor will point out the salient points that need to be watched. If you're doing anything wrong, obviously he being the instructor will tell you not to how to correct your fault, you see. But found no great difficulty in converting and flying them. Well, having flown the Hotspur, we were used to flying gliders, and we got a superior glider to fly, which was to our advantage.
Now, what do you remember of you? Because on a lot of the flights, you used to practice carrying troops, didn't you? Tell us about that.
Yes, that was most interesting. As I say, we could carry up to 30 troops, and these men from the glider-borne regiments, they were glider-borne troops. They come along to have a first flight, and myself and my second pilot, my co-pilot, would stand by the planing steps, and as they came along, each of these men looked straight into your face, trying to form an impression, or saying, is this the man who's going to fly us? And of human nature, they all looked straight into your face to try and evaluate you and see if they could form an impression of what you're going to be like.
And would you try and cheer them up, or
what? Well, sometimes, we used to do If we got very, very nice calm weather, we were flying them for air experience. When we cast off tow, we used to tow about the maximum towing speed was 140 miles per hour. It was miles per hour in those days, not knots. We used to tow about perhaps 110, 120 miles an hour. Now, as soon as you came off tow, you pressed the red button and the tow rope fell away and you were in free flight. You had to reduce your speed to a gliding speed, and the gliding speed for a fully loaded glider was about 90 miles an hour, so you had to come down from say 120 to 90 miles an hour. You could do that two ways. You could lose it gradually or if you wanted to give the trooper a bit of a thrill, as soon as you come off tow, you pull the stick back in your stomach, the glider would literally stand on his tail, and then when you got to the 90 mile an hour, you just put the nose down. You hear the gas from the soldiers at the back, wondering what was happening to them. So it's strictly unofficial, but we used to do it occasionally.
Now, what about night flying? Because there's aspects of that, different aspects. You couldn't see the towing aircraft, could you? So how could you keep in state?
Well, on the trailing edge of the wings of the towing aircraft, there were two on each wing of the trailing edge, four blue lights, and you position those in a certain, you got them a certain height through your perspex cover that you look through, and you knew if you had the lights so many inches above the bottom of the perspex, you got the perspex in front of you through you look through, and of course the bottom of the perspex, and if you got the blue lights a certain distance off from the bottom of the perspex, you knew you were in more or less in the correct position. It was difficult with the lights.
And anything else about night flying?
No, I've already explained to you the night flying at
the landing, yes,
at the GTS, and it was just as similar, except it was a larger aircraft.
Now, this course didn't last long, did it? You finished the course mid-May 1943, so just a month.
Just a month to make sure we were fully conversant with the aircraft. And to get 20 hours flying in a glider is a lot more difficult than getting 20 hours in a powered aircraft, because each time the glider landed had to be towed around by men, had to be marshalled again, and all that took time, so you couldn't get your hours in very quickly, so that's probably why it took a month.
You still haven't practiced any mass flight, so?
Not at all, no.
Now, anything else? So what's next then? You've qualified, now you get posted to your regiment, I presume.
I just can't remember where I went after Bryce Norton.
We just looked up, and it's a glider pilot experimental unit at RAF Netherhaven. You went there in, 16th of May 1943.
Oh, yes, I remember we went to Netherhaven, yes.
Now, what do you remember of that time?
Well, Netherhaven was one of the original Royal Flying Corps aerodromes, a grass aerodrome, well-known aerodrome, and we had a horses stationed there, and we went down there, and we had boffins coming along from the Air Ministry, and we tried various devices, such as mounting machine guns to fire from the side of the glider.
What do you remember of these experiments?
Well, that's one where the thread tried firing machine guns from the from the glider wasn't very successful.
Why not?
I don't know. I actually wasn't involved in that particular one, but they never adopted, so evidently it wasn't feasible. But the one I remember once was going off with a boffin from the Air Ministry, and he said he had some sort of instrument with him. I don't know what it was, all top secret. And he said, "Fly as I tell you. And if the flying you're doing becomes dangerous, just assume your normal flying procedure." You have some sort of an instrument, I think it was a blind flying device, and they were trying it out. Everything was very, very hush-hush. They never told you what it was for. That's the one I remember most, this blind flying device they were testing.
It seems to be mainly in Hotspurs and Tiger Moths there.
At
the glider pilot experimental unit.
Yeah, I don't remember flying Hotspurs there. I may have done, but I mainly was flying the horses at Netherhaven.
Yes, you go on to horses later in June. Then you are flying quite a lot, yeah. You also did some low flying runs. What about that? Do you remember that?
Yes, well, I've already described the low flying runs in the Hotspur. We did similar ones in the horses. I can't remember the actual height. We weren't very, very high above the ground. And obviously we stayed clear of inhabited areas or farmhouses or anything like that, just because there's plenty of scope and soldiers were planning to find a place where nobody lived and you could use fly over there.
Now, you're there till June, and then you go to RAF Thruxton.
Yes, I was only a short period at RAF Thruxton. I can't remember what we were doing there, to be quite truthful.
So what's the next thing you remember? Before we leave Netherhaven, you do a long flight, don't you, to RAF Lucas?
Oh, yes.
Tell us about that, I think we'll leave RAF Thruxton, you don't remember that at all.
No.
It looks to me like some of what you just said was actually, because the experimental air firing was at RAF Thruxton. So I think there might be some, it might be together with the time at Netherhaven. So
yeah.
So tell me about this long flight to Lucas.
Yeah, one day I was detailed to fly with an RAF, two of us, I forget who my co-pilot was, were taken in an RAF aircraft and flown from Netherhaven to Lucas in 5 to collect a Horsa glider and 5 back down from Lucas back down to Netherhaven. We arrived at Lucas all right, but we didn't get away until the next day because during the time we were there, a WAF was attacked and molested in a billet. And the whole airfield was sealed up both by the RAF police and the civil police and the Scottish civil police. And we all had to line up, every man on the aerodrome had to line up, and they came along and inspected your face and hands for scratches. Whether they ever found anybody or not, I don't know. But eventually we got the all clear and we flew back down from Lucas. I always remember flying over to Bass Rock.
And why in particular?
Because I'd never seen it before. It was an island. I think, if I remember right, there were plenty of birds on it at Bass Rock. It's in the Firth of Forth. And I don't know how long it took us to fly down. It'll be in my logbook somewhere. But we got back to Netherhaven, and it was quite an experience to do something different, to fly all that distance.
So anything else? You don't remember Thruxton, but so what next? It looks like in August, you seem to get post to 1st Battalion. Is that when you get post? Do you see what I mean? Do you get posted to them then?
Does it say where?
Well, the 1st Battalion that proceeds to North Africa. It didn't say you join them in the account. It just says, I presume you do join them before you go.
But to North Africa. Does it say which boat I was on? I don't think I remember.
No. So you joined them on the boat, did you? When did you... Or you don't remember when you joined first?
No, I don't remember. Don't remember.
So what do you remember about the voyage? You went with the 1st Battalion Glider Pilot Regiment.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of where we sailed from.
Liverpool.
I don't remember the name of the troop ship.
And what do you remember about the trip?
Can you switch off a moment, please? I had an uneventual voyage in the troop ship via the Bay of Biscay through the Mediterranean and landed at Algiers. Nothing. No enemy aircraft, no enemy submarines, nothing. It was quite a pleasant voyage. We landed at Algiers. I also remember Algiers looking at it like a big white city on a hill. A massive white building coming from the top of the hill right to the seaside. And we disembarked from the ship and went to Maison-Carré, which is some miles outside of Algiers. And there we didn't do any military training for a while. We just stayed there and enjoyed ourselves swimming in the sea and having a reasonably good time and drinking the Algerian wine.
And so you had no real military duties?
No.
And what did you think of that? It's your first really foreign country, wouldn't it? I mean, England and Ireland, yeah, all you've seen before. What did you think of it?
Well, the first thing I noticed was the scruffiness, with all due respect, of the French colonial troops who were guarding the municipal and civil buildings. I thought to myself, they wouldn't pass muster in our regiment. No, I don't know if they were Senegalese or what, they were Algerians, but they weren't as smart as we were. But apart from that, it was a marvellous experience to see native women and the way they dress and the men going about their business and just the different coloured faces than the rest of us.
And what about the climate and the prevailing sights and smells?
There was a peculiar smell of the city, I can't describe it, and the weather was absolutely beautiful as far as we were concerned. Absolutely beautiful weather. As I said, we spent our time bathing and not doing very much, that's the way in the next move.
Now, then you go by train, don't you? Tell us the story of that. You go to Sousse, Tunisia.
We entrained from Algiers to Sousse on a train, not a passenger train, in cattle trucks.
What was it like? What were conditions like?
Oh, they were not too bad because we had plenty of room. We weren't all squeezed into the cattle trucks. We had plenty of room to move around. We used to sit with our legs out over the side, open the door of the cattle trucks, and legs over the side. But quite a few of us got our legs and our knees burned, having exposed them to too much sun because we were in khaki drill uniform. And we reached Sousse, went through the town, from the town of Sousse, we were taken by lorry from the train station to olive trees of olive groves, and we slept in the open underneath the olive groves.
So this was, you're just moving up?
Yes.
The fighting had finished in Africa by then?
Yeah, more or less, and the invasion of Sicily had already taken place as well. So we were just waiting for further orders.
And you then seemed to go to Bizerta by truck, do you remember that?
Yes, well, a very short notice. As I said, we didn't know what was going to happen to us, but a very short notice we were informed by our officers we were going by truck to Bizerta.
What was that journey like?
There was a chance to see more of North Africa. And it was just across, I forget the mileage from Sousse to Bizerta, but we were on the trucks quite a few hours. We went down to the docks at Bizerta. We had no problems, nothing untoward happened. And there we embarked upon the Dutch ship, the Princess Beatrix.
This is after Salerno. Salerno, I think, is what, 3rd of September or something. I can't quite remember. What do you remember about the Princess Beatrix?
Well, as I say, it was a Dutch ship. We were pretty crowded on there. And we sailed, again, with no problems at sea from any enemy submarines or aircraft, none at all. And we went in convoy to land at Taranto in the heat of Italy, to find all the dock installations had been blown up by the Germans before they left. But there was no opposition because the Germans had made a military stand further up Italy. So they decided not to oppose our landings.
And you had an unpleasant job when you first got there, connected with the sinking of the HMS Abdil, is it?
Yeah, HMS
Abdil. Tell us about that.
HMS Abdil was also in our convoy. And I didn't actually see it. It may have been a few days after we got there, in a different convoy. Well, that was full of a complement of parachute troops from the Royal, I forget which battalion it was.
Doesn't matter.
And it struck a mine on the approach to Taranto Harbour and blew up. And we were, for days afterwards, we were collecting the dead bodies.
So you actually had to do that?
We had to do it, yeah.
And what would you do when you got the bodies?
We got the bodies. All we did was we usually had the party with us, and some of our officers, of course. And the first thing was to get the identification disc of the man who was the dead man, so to know who he was. Then they had a party which we were not concerned with, in removing the bodies and taking them away for burial. We were just assisting getting out of the water, out of the sea.
Now what happened next then? Seemed to go to up near Barry, Butigana?
We went up to, we then moved up a bit more up country. And we're based in a little town called Putignano, which is near Barry, in the school. And according to the local civilians, they told us that the German army used the same school as we did. They evacuated.
What were they like as billets?
Oh, well, it's just a normal classroom when we slept down on the floor in bedrolls and that. Yes. And we were always besieged by the Italian children because we got plenty of food and we used to share it with the children. And we were amazed to find that in this small town they had a marvellous ice cream salon. The Italians are famous for ice cream. We used to ask the children to go and fetch us ice cream and we give them some food or money in return. So we made great friends with the local Italian children.
What about the older Italians? How were you getting? They'd only just finished, they'd left the war a month before.
Yeah.
How did you get on with the Italians?
Very, very friendly. We had no animosity, and they seemed to like the British. We had no animosity from them at all. But I also remember the British propaganda. And not long after, the village we were in, Putignano, and the surrounding towns had big posters put on them and says, Garibaldi says, England is always our friend. And that was British propaganda, reminding the Italian people, locals, what Garibaldi had said about the British. So hopefully they would think the same, that they were our friends. I thought it was quite a good bit of propaganda.
Now, you also came into contact with some of the Italian army. What did you think of them?
Well, we first saw some Italian soldiers and they had an anti-aircraft gun. They were manning an aircraft gun. But the first thing that struck us was the amount of rubbish and debris outside around the gun area. In the British Army, everything was clean and tidy, but they weren't. There was rubbish and all sorts, and we thought, well, that again is not up to our standard. But they were very, very friendly, made friends with us, tried to talk to us. In a mixture of Italian and English, we managed to get on. And they showed no animosity. I think they were pleased that the war had finished, really.
Now, one thing that happened there was you formed a friendship with two local girls. Do you want to tell that story? Because that's quite a nice story. Although it starts quite badly, doesn't it? Because it starts with you being threatened. Tell us the whole story.
Well, my friend Ken Bottomley, unfortunately, has now left us. And I, we had a free day. So we hitched a lift into Barry. Looked at the town, quite a nice town. Went to a bar, an ice cream parlour to get some ice cream. And we had a bit of difficulty making ourselves understood. Now, sitting in the restaurant were two Italian girls. And one of them, as we passed, said, "Can we help you?" One of the girls said, "Oh, of course." And we formed a friendship with the two girls from then on, Rosa Visconti and Bina Bianchi. They were university students, and one of them, Bina Bianchi, her brother, was a prisoner of war in India. He was in an Italian submarine. They didn't know what had ever happened to him, but he was a prisoner of war in India, her brother. So she got an interest in the war. And we were very, 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 very good friends.
Now, there's one occasion where you're attacked by the Indians, aren't you?
Oh, yes.
No, not attacked, but no, threatened. You feel threatened. What
yeah. about them? They were beautiful Italian girls, really lovely girls, physically very, very attractive. And we're walking through the town of Barry with them, and some soldiers, I don't know if it was the 4th or 5th British Indian Division, were there. And they saw us, and I don't know what they thought, that the girls were loose women or what they were, but they thought they might like a form of friendship with them. And they followed us all through the place. In the end, it got a bit threatening. So we went up to a bridge which was being guarded by the Italian army, who had not been disarmed. So the Italian army, more or less liaised with these Indians, told them to leave us alone, not to follow us. So we were glad to use the Italian army to help us out. apart from that, we had no problems.
Now, the other thing is, you seem to have been on the occasional patrol. I'm not sure. Now, what sort of patrol? Are these just police patrols? What sort of patrolling were you doing?
To be quite, I can't remember much about the patrols, but they must have been very exciting or very important, because otherwise I would have remembered.
Were these just routine patrols? Just, you weren't in the front line.
No, not at all. Just routine patrols. Just establishing what the area was like around the town of Putignano. And making ourselves known to the local populace.
There's one case, when you got near to Casamissima.
Casamissima.
You frightened them a bit. Is that the same sort of patrol? Tell us about that.
Can't remember that.
Okay, that's all right. Now, you don't actually do any active service in Italy at all?
Not at all.
So how did it all come to an end?
Well, it came to an end when we met Bina and Rosa, and said, we'll see you probably a week on Thursday, I think it was. I'll see you next Thursday, it was almost a week away. We never saw them again, because in between, at a very, very short notice, we were sent back to the UK. So we never had a chance to say goodbye to them.
So that was you set off back in November?
November, yeah. 43.
Now, you've got one of these poems you want to read. You're just going to read this poem called The Italian Girls from Bari, a Soldier's Tale, that you wrote long after the war, I presume.
The Italian Girls from Bari, a Soldier's Tale. On a bus to Stockport, I chanced to see a poster with an appeal to youth, whose aim was to attract recruits. Be a Millennium Soldier, join the Cheshires and be the best. In an instant, I was not on the bus, but back in the army in 1943. One of a squad of young soldiers living under the old trees at Sousse. At the time, there was not much to do, but enjoyed Tunisia at its sunny best. Then in September, all that changed. At short notice, we were on trucks, bound for Bizerta, 180 miles away. Italy had surrendered, and we were part of the Allied occupation force, to sail on the Princess Beatrix, a Dutch ship, destination Taranto, and then to disembark, and to be based at Putignano in Calabria, a little town which was to be our Italian home. My friend Ken and I, off duty, hitched a lift to Bari on the Adriatic Sea, something new to see, drink the wine, take in the town, and for a while be free of duty and enjoy the scene. In an ice cream parlour, as we relaxed, our maroon berries and glider wings attracted the glances of two local girls. They had not seen British soldiers before, and like us, were young and not yet been influenced by religion or race. They spoke to us in English. Their English was good, being language students at the university. Rosa Visconti and Bina Bianchi were the names. They were cultured, attractive and good company. We realised how fortunate we were to have met them and enjoyed the time spent in getting to know each other. We became friends, and future meetings were easily looked forward to. Physical relationships did not prevail. A meeting of minds and exchange of ideas was sufficient for our friendship to endure. We met them whenever we could and arranged a Thursday liaison a week ahead. But alas, that was not to be. But then we were homeward bound by sea. No way to say our time together had ended. They must have realised we were not to blame, and that military duty had to be done. I think of our last time together, and wonder if being you, we were to part forever. As we said goodbye, until next time, she took my hand, looked at me, and gently placed it on her breast. In this innocent act, with no words said, perhaps she showed her love and thanks to the British soldier, who only for a short period showed her affection and respect. 50 years have passed since then, and I often wonder if an elderly lady, sitting in the Italian sun, fondly remembers the British glider pilot she met, as indeed I nostalgically recall it all when she, Rosa, Ken and I were young.